Welcome to Mental Illness in Pop Culture. This week we're going to delve into the Beach Boys. I'm Scott.
This is Leanne.
This is Joe.
Yes, we have guest podcaster Mark McGowan. Mark, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
It's so simple.
I want to mention how this came about and how you came to be joining us for this. We were wanting to do a podcast on the Beach Boys, and we couldn't find anybody to be the guest. And then you were interviewing us, and it turns out you're a big Beach Boys fan.
True.
So could you tell us a little bit about how you got into the Beach Boys?
When I was maybe 10 years old, my mom and I were driving somewhere, and on the radio we heard California Girls. I had never heard that before. I was only 10, and the opening section with the orchestral sound and music just blew me away. I insisted my mom take me to the store so that I could buy California Girls on 45. I was just a kid. I had limited income. We found California Girls on 45, but we also found the Beach Boys Super Hits, an 18-track record for about the exact same amount of money. So I splurged and bought that, and then I got totally hooked and just started spending any money I could find on Beach Boys records, and eventually realized it wasn't so much the Beach Boys I loved, but Brian Wilson.
Well, that's interesting because that sort of segues into how I got into the Beach Boys, and I'm still pretty much a casual fan, but in the early days of AOL, and you used to get those little aluminum coasters in the mail constantly, and so I was frequently on the AOL discussion boards, and I remember the title of the Beach Boys discussion folder was The Beach Boys, parentheses, a.k.a. Brian Wilson. And that was my first hint that there was more to the Beach Boys than songs about surfing girls and cars. And there was more to just thinking about them as a lame oldies act, which is what I had thought about until that time.
Yeah, the Beach Boys are always kind of ubiquitous. They were always on the radio somewhere, I remember when I was growing up. But I don't think that I actually began to take notice of them until there was a Beatles documentary somewhere in the mid-90s, a three-part documentary that aired on ABC. And in that documentary, McCartney was talking about Pet Sounds and Pet Sounds influencing Sgt. Pepper's. And that's the first time I was like, oh, I guess I should probably listen to this album, Pet Sounds, and it wasn't like anything that I had ever really associated with the Beach Boys and all the surf and sand and all that stuff. But after that, it was like, wow, this man, Brian Wilson, is just something else.
So he said he saw a documentary and you kind of blazed over, I really liked this cool vibe.
Vibrations.
That's my animal bun. All right. That's all I've got. I'm not an expert on this. But how did you realize? I mean, what was that transition where it's this groovy music and then what you found out you love was Brian?
Well, at one point during those same early teen years, I bought the album Surf's Up, not knowing what it would be. And I remember getting home and putting it on my record player and not understanding at all what I was listening to because it sounded so completely different than the surf car girl songs from the early 60s. Mm-hmm. And at first, I absolutely hated it. But, you know, I didn't own any records. I kept going back to it. And then as I started buying books about the Beach Boys, then I realized, you know, that it was all Brian. And the advanced chord progressions and the crazy background vocals, you know, that all that stuff was him, and that I soon realized I appreciated the more head music much more than the surfing music.
So right before we started recording, you mentioned to us that you're in kind of a local band and you do keyboards.
True.
You think that was, I mean, were you into music before 10?
I started playing piano, taking piano lessons when I was 5, okay. And I was terrible for years. And to the point where I was ready to quit. At the end, I did get a Beach Boys songbook, an actual book of the Endless Summer songs, but in sheet music, and started teaching myself how to play those songs, learn the chord progressions, learned how to turn chord symbols into notes on the piano, and that me playing the piano all these years.
So can you play the intro to Wouldn't It Be Nice?
I can play the intro to California Girls.
Joe, before we hit record, you had mentioned the Beach Boys. How can we cram this all into one episode? Because there's just so much. What kinds of things were you thinking about?
Well, as I remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, but we originally started talking about focusing on the film Love and Mercy.
Oh, yeah. Right.
And then, as you know, as we went through scheduling and whatnot, and we started adding, you know, well, you can check out this documentary, or you can read this article.
There are so many things on YouTube about the Beach Boys.
By the time all that got done, and I had already seen several documentaries about the Beach Boys, and I went back and watched Love and Mercy again, and it was like, okay, so we can talk about Brian Wilson's music, we can talk about his family life, we can talk about his actual mental illnesses, we can talk about medical ethics with
Eugene Landy, yeah.
We can talk about family and spouses and how they deal with their significant other having mental illness. Like his second wife, whose name I've just completely forgotten.
Melinda Ledbetter.
With Melinda. So there was like so much. It was like, all right, how are we going to get through all this? But we're in it, so let's do it.
I was thinking maybe start with family dynamics in the Wilson family. And we could spend the whole episode, I think, just on that. One thing that stands out to me, though, is birth order. Mm-hmm. And so we've got Brian, the oldest, then Dennis, then Carl. And they really fit the prototypical birth order roles. So Brian, the hero, the star, Dennis, second born, and the first born is already the best at being the best. And the second born, they need to forge out their own identity. And so often they become the best at being the worst. And so he's the rebel, the problem child, the scapegoat. Then we've got third born, Carl. And the third born is sometimes called the lost child or the angel or the invisible one. Carl, the quiet beach boy. And then Carl is also the youngest. And that role sometimes plays out as being kind of a mascot, like the cute little one. And so we've really got almost an exaggerated version of those roles in the Wilson family.
Yeah, and reading interviews that that Brian did, especially later, interviews in the 2000s, I mean, all of his interviews are kind of interesting because he doesn't take long, extended answers like this one. But you could tell that he had a lot of love for his brothers, and mm-hmm. that he misses them terribly because both Carl and Denny have since died. Carl drowned.
Dennis drowned.
Dennis drowned in the ocean. Presumably after being pretty loaded.
Well, that's a big issue with Dennis. Yeah. There's a lot of addiction going on. In fact, of the bazillion things on YouTube, there's lots of interviews with Dennis. Every single one, he is wasted.
Mm. Well, I mean, that does have to be quite a bit to stand up to. Because he was a drummer.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, right? And drummers tend to be obscured because they're behind the drum round. And so since they're in the back, it doesn't really matter how much they bring to the music. They're still kind of obscured by the front man. But it's even more amplified with Brian because he wasn't even on stage. Right. But his presence loomed so large, especially with the canon of songs. And as they get into the mid-60s with this run of Pet Sounds and Smile, you know, there's like no more air there for someone like Dennis.
He was kind of the sex symbol of the band. So he was the one that was really the most appealing to women and girls.
But sex gets boring.
How old are you?
You all know what I mean.
He was very musically talented, though. You know, he was the first Beach Boy to create a solo album.
Pacific Ocean Blue, which is a beautiful,
yeah. gorgeous record. And some of his songs for the Beach Boys, such as Forever, are just, you know, heartbreaking.
Yeah.
They're so beautiful.
Yeah.
But then all of this is, like, so framed by the relationship with their dad.
Well, right. We really need to bring Murray into the picture. I mean, to call him abusive is probably an understatement. You know, you have to wonder, well, I mean, some of that probably resulted in Brian needing to find a creative outlet, but he seems, I can't think of the name, but in Amadeus,
who? Scalieri.
Thank you. He reminds me of Scalieri.
Yeah.
In that he's always trying to live up to the genius of Brian, and he can never do it. And he was a frustrated songwriter himself.
Yeah. But then you see interviews with Brian where Brian is referring to him as, you know, what was true. I mean, I don't know if I ever heard Brian say his dad was abusive necessarily.
No.
But he does refer to him as being this guy that got them into this recording studio and pushed him and got in his face and said, you better go in there, and, you know, whatever. And then he goes, and then we would go in there and do that. So he has some, and I don't know if it's self-preservation or defense mechanism, but he definitely has some high regard to his dad's expertise in the field.
It's almost like he could compartmentalize his dad.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's this really domineering, painful or pain-inflicting man, and then there's this artist that wants to get out. And, you know, there's a point in the movie where Murray comes into the studio to play basically his new version of the Beach Boys.
Right.
And Brian's like, good for you, you're doing your own thing. And I think probably take that as being, you know, this glib dismissal, but I felt like in that moment, he was like, honest. You know, it's like, good for you, Dad, you're doing your own thing. Go out there and do that, but I gotta do this.
And also felt, that scene also felt like for me that Brian had found some freedom.
Oh, yeah.
That, you know, my dad has signed this band that sounds just like our old stuff. And he's so excited about it. I can be free to go right back in the studio and work on what I want to work on.
Yeah.
Which, ironically, of course, he's in the middle of a fight with another family member, his cousin Mike Love, right. That everybody knows.
Yeah.
About that very point, you know, because Mike wants to go back to the tried and true formula and not branch out and explore the creativity. That whole relationship is just tense, and apparently it still is tense.
Mm-hmm. If we can go back to Murray for just a
second.
Please,
yeah.
There's a couple of things that in the movie that are about Murray that just strike the both times. The scene where they're at the restaurant, and Brian is describing the spankings that a normal child would receive, and then the spankings that he and his brothers received, and he's hitting his hand as hard, pounding on the table, and Melinda is taken aback. She can't, you know, understand what's going on. And also the scene where Brian is playing God Only Knows for his dad on the piano, and Murray is completely dismissive of it. Just hates the song, you know, and ends up kicking him out of the house. Or the scene where Murray comes and says, I've sold all the publishing rights to your songs.
For $700,000.
Right, and it's brutal. And that says that your music was never going to make more money anyway, and Brian just lays his head against the wall. I mean, all those things are so, so sad. But then in reality, at some point after all those events took place, Brian and his dad wrote a song together called Breakaway, which is a fantastic, beautiful song. And his dad, for some reason, took a pseudonym on that. It was Reggie Dunbar.
Yeah.
But it's a fantastic song. So, you know, so at that point, Brian still was able to incorporate his dad into his musical life.
Well, yeah, I watched quite a bit in preparation for this, and Brian hardly or never says an unkind word about anybody.
Yeah.
Not
yeah.
his dad, not Mike Love, even though they both, he would have plenty to vent about related to them, but he's just, even there was a recent review that came out, and it was contrasting Mike Love's memoir with Brian Wilson's recent autobiography. And I wrote something down, and it said, he was born with something that makes most of us look like useless, self-satisfied monkeys. He has a talent so extreme, it's hard to believe that he was not in some way touched by the hand of the Lord. And so he never has anything bad to say about anyone. And so he's just, I mean, he's almost like otherworldly in that way.
Hell, he didn't even have anything bad to say about Landy.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah.
Which is, I mean, I guess, you know, speaking of my, you know, from my perspective, that strikes me as kind of odd, because I feel, that's kind of silly for me to even say, I feel like I would be way pissed at that guy, ready to mount as many lawsuits as I possibly could with what Landy did to him on a daily basis. But I'm not Brian.
Well, there was lasting damage from lasting physical damage from Landy. So in the interviews that we now see with Brian from the 2000s and even a couple of years ago, and he has some quirky behavior going on, and what that is called tardive dyskinesia, and that is a side effect of very strong psychotropic medication. And all of that medication that Landy had him on for so long, it did permanent damage to him.
What was his actual
diagnosis? His actual diagnosis?
My research says it's schizoaffective is the original.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Landy had diagnosed him as paranoid schizophrenia, but that was retracted. Mm-hmm. And so, schizoaffective with mild bipolar disorder. And in addition to that, all of his drug use from the 60s also may have done some brain damage.
And 70s.
And 70s, yeah.
I saw an interview or read an interview where he was talking about he was on a lot of psychedelic drugs in his early 20s, and that he's first started hearing voices for the first time at 25, and that they would yell like his dad would. Mm. And in fact, playing music louder and writing more often would drown that, and it was kind of his way to keep it quiet. But I looked up risk factors then for schizoaffective, and it says, you know, the normal genetics, brain chemistry, and structure, but stress and particularly those types of drug use can cause that disorder in a person. So it's all related.
Yeah. Clearly.
One of the reasons when I asked in my original interview about the podcast, about Love and Mercy, is my fascination with Brian Wilson, but I wanted to get a clinical idea from someone like you, Scott, about all the different things, because there are so many narratives about how he ended up this way, and you've just touched on one of them, and another one with the drugs. You know, there's the famous incident on the airplane, which is depicted in the movie, where they show him having a nervous breakdown because he's got the stage fright, he's tired of Capitol Records pushing him for more product constantly. He's writing, he's producing, he's recording, he's touring, and he has this breakdown on the plane. And there's also, you know, the famous scene where he takes the LSD for the first time, and he said in so many interviews since then, it just blew my mind.
Yeah.
My mind was blown. You know, there's the whole history of the child abuse. You know, there are so many narratives. And then I brought this book in. The book I brought is called Heroes and Villains. It's by Stephen Gaines in 1986. And there's a section in here about when Mike Love had a nervous breakdown and he was hospitalized. And then it says in this book, in later years, Mike would later explain away the incident, saying he had been, quote, tainted by the Wilson blood.
That's cold blood.
But that adds yet another dimension to me, that why Brian is the way he is, that it's in his DNA. The Wilson blood is tainted.
Yeah,
it's genetic predisposition.
For sure, is always a consideration.
You know, so yeah, I wonder, is it one of those things? Is it all those things?
Well, that makes me, that kind of forces the question, is there anything in the written record anywhere that talks about any of these kinds of mental illnesses appearing in anyone else in the family other than Mike Love?
Well, Mike's nephew, Kevin Love, who now plays for the Cleveland Cavaliers, he has a really nice article. I'm going to see if I can pull up the opening paragraph of that. He says, on November 5th, right after halftime against the Hawks, I had a panic attack. It came out of nowhere. I'd never had one before. I didn't even know they were real. But it was real as a broken hand or sprained ankle. Since that day, almost everything about the way I think about my mental health has changed. So there really does seem to be sort of a genetic predisposition for mental health issues within this larger family. In terms of what happens within a given person, there needs to be that genetic predisposition combined with some kind of precipitating event, and that can trigger that happening.
Sure.
And Brian, being 25 with the onset, that fits right within the average, the age of onset for men, which I believe is 18 to 26. There was a book, I never read it, I just know the title, called It Takes Three Generations to Make a Schizophrenic. That isn't really scientifically thought to be true at this point, but I've wondered about Murray's father and how did he get to be the way he did?
On his own, right? Yeah. After his experiences.
So who knows how far something like that could go back. So we started to talk somewhat about Pet Sounds and Smile, and Paul McCartney, Pet Sounds is his favorite album. I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about those albums.
With Joy.
Yeah.
Such great. They're so lush and rich. And it's like you hear something different every time.
Yeah.
Every time.
It's just amazing records.
Well, and there was that competition with the Beatles going on at the time. And Brian, I don't know if this was his first LSD trip or not, but I know he was just mesmerized by Rubber Soul. Yeah. And that kind of pushed him to try to take it further. And so he did Pet Sounds, and the Beatles did Sgt. Pepper. Then they made recordings for Smile, but by this time, Brian was over the edge. And so Smile, or versions of it, didn't come out until much later. I would say Smile reminds me more of Magical Mystery Tour, in that it's a little more indulgent and going in lots of different directions.
A little more whimsical.
Yeah. Now, I do have kind of a heretical thought about Pet Sounds.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. Now, somebody, and it might have been Lester Bangs, but music critic, somebody said that Sgt. Pepper is really a day in the life. And I would say about Pet Sounds is really God Only Knows, also with Wouldn't It Be Nice. And in both cases, you've got the greatest song or songs in the world, and then some really interesting songs too. But for me, Pet Sounds, God Only Knows, I listen to that on repeat all the time.
God Only Knows. It is incredible.
On YouTube, you can find isolated vocal versions of that. It's just amazing.
You want to go?
I agree. To me, the song, though, that on Pet Sounds that always knocks me for a loop is I Just Wasn't Made for These Times.
Yeah, okay.
Which is near the end of Side 2. And to me, that is the most vulnerable he gets on there. You know, it's not a song about girls. It's a song about not fitting in, you know, feeling you're from the wrong place or time. And it, you know, that one is, you know, of course, the music is gorgeous, but the lyrics are just, you know, just touch you. But I would agree with you that those that God Only Knows by far is just stellar. The French horn, the harmonies.
You could make an argument that it is the greatest pop song ever written.
I think that I get that sentiment that, you know, the album is God Only Knows or Sgt. Pepper's is really only a day in the life. If you're looking at it as a collection of singles. And I don't think that you can look at either one of those albums, and especially a Pet Sounds, as merely a collection of singles, because
yes, it needs to be listened through.
So what Brian was trying to get away from, you know, cranking out single after single after single after single and just haphazardly putting together onto a 13 or 14 song collection. And here in 63, 64, 65, we start seeing this shift in the album being becoming the fundamental root of pop music as opposed to just the song.
The story, yeah.
And so on that score, Pet Sounds and Sgt. Pepper's and Sgt. Pepper's and What's Going On is What's Going On.
You convinced me.
I always think about, you know, he made some concessions on Pet Sounds. You know, he did not want Sloop John B on the record, but there it is. Mm-hmm. He wanted to call the song Hang On To Your Ego.
Yeah.
But it's called I Know There's An Answer, and the word ego's not in there. And that Caroline No.
Satisfied Mike.
Yeah. Caroline No is sped up at Murray's request or Murray's insistence to make Brian sound younger. So even though he was completely in charge in that studio, that he was telling these seasoned studio musicians how to play their parts and knew exactly what he wanted, by the time that the boys came back to put down their vocals, he had to make one concession after another to let it go.
Yeah, deferent to Murray, as always.
Father figures loom large.
Well, everybody has daddy issues.
So why is it that we don't really hear very much about his mom?
Audrey.
Yeah.
I saw what's the documentary that you have on here? I have access to Scott's Prime.
Actually, I think it is called I Just Wasn't Made for These Times.
That's right, yeah.
Oh, and she's in that.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's in that. Very, I don't know what adjectives are for her. She's a little stoic. She's definitely, I mean, she loves her kid. I mean, you get that, but I don't think she's seeing what we see. You know, he's a good boy, you know?
Yeah, they make references to her being an alcoholic. I've seen that.
Yeah.
And they mention it in the movie. There's a scene where old Brian is telling Melinda that his mom drank a lot.
Yeah, I was just going to say, when you were talking about mental illness in the family earlier, I don't know if it's just her age in that particular documentary and she's just, you know, reflecting and maybe doesn't have a clear memory, or if there's something there, but I would not be surprised if, you know, there's something or had been some co-occurring activity early.
That's interesting.
I think most of her part of the narrative is, of the whole Beach Boys story, is just telling the boys that he's your dad, you know, just he means well. That's her main role, is to be the ambassador for Murray.
Yeah. I just kind of think of her as codependent. Not knowing very much about her, but because Murray was so dominating, and then the kids with the birth order roles.
And generationally possibly appropriate. I mean, if they're raising kids in the 50s, and I mean, it looks like that. She talks her more that kind of traditional wife at home role kind of thing.
Mark, in your researching of Brian, has anything been written about Murray's reaction to Brian's various diagnoses?
Not that I've ever read.
Like, how did he feel?
Yeah, he kind of exits the story in the late 60s once he sold the music rights. And I know he wrote the song Breakaway that I mentioned, but then in, you know, most stories that you read, he doesn't re-enter the picture until he dies.
Yeah,
and Brian is in bed and is told that his father has died, and it bothers him, but he can't get out of bed to go to the funeral.
And
that's kind of the end of Murray.
Literally and figuratively.
I think Dennis also did not.
Yeah, go. That's true.
I don't. Well, let's talk about a little more about Dennis. So he was friends with Charles Manson.
Yeah.
Do you know how that came about?
I didn't research enough, but I believe he picked him up or went back to his house and found him there partying or something. Yeah. You know, Dennis had a house that he didn't use, and found that Manson and his followers had just encamped, and Manson had women for the having, and Dennis wanted to have those women, and
the rest is history.
There you go. In fact, there is Charles Manson song that Dennis recorded with the Beach Boys. I'll never think of the title right now.
Yeah, but didn't they changed
they the changed title? The name and took Manson's name off it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and
it's like just mental illness all around. It is surrounding all around his family. You know, it's really interesting.
Yeah. One of my main sources for information about the Beach Boys, of course, is one of my favorite Facebook pages called Mike Love is a Douchebag.
He is.
So I guess how I first became aware of that phenomena, and there's quite a bit of information on that Facebook book page to make the case for that title, but was the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction. And Mike, in his acceptance speech, he went off on quite a rant, criticizing Jagger and the Boss for not working as hard as he did with the Beach Boys.
What did he do? What did he do? I mean, Brian was the genius. Brian was the orchestrator. Brian.
Well, I wonder if there's something about him living in the shadow of Brian's genius. By the way, genius does not come without baggage.
No, that, yeah, absolutely.
And I
don't know. I have no clue of what it's like to be a genius.
I think Mike Love is one of the luckiest.
Yeah.
You know, he was working at his dad's iron or metal shop, you know, and his cousin happened to be Brian Wilson. And 50-some years later, you know, Mike Love is still very rich and very famous. And
well, I mean, to his credit, Mike does have an amazing voice and is a really iconic voice.
Yes.
And it's one of those voices that you know when you hear it. But I think Mike also... I do think he was deeply jealous of Brian. And when they came back from that tour of Japan to work on the Pet Sounds, on laying down the vocal tracks for Pet Sounds, I think that he was just so misunderstanding of what Brian was trying to do. Because Brian was at that point where he just didn't give a damn about hits. It's like, that's... I mean, it was clear that hits were easy. And in the film, at least the way it's depicted in the film, the scene when Murray comes in with his faux Beach Boys band.
Yeah.
And he says, "You hear that? That's a hit." I was sitting there thinking to myself, wait a minute. Your son's written like 18 hits by this point. So he knows what a hit sounds like. And, you know, to not trust the artist, especially when they're at the height of their powers, I wonder how many quote-unquote genius artists of any medium has to deal with that, with that questioning, you know. And hence they end up sequestering themselves from everyone else and just having a couple of key selected supportive people in their mix.
Well, music is a business. That's the sad part of all this is that, you know, underneath it all, it is a business. It's dollars and cents. There are a lot of suits,
Heroes and villains.
And heroes, yes.
So I have, you know, in just Love and Mercy and the documentaries and whatever, and I didn't know very much about Brian Wilson before this, but makes me sad, you know, just in general. The story's kind of heartfelt, obviously, and so I'm weird enough to do research, particularly on his net worth now, because I wanted to somehow feel better that all these things had happened and he was still cranking it. So he, in 2017, don't know, $75 million. Interestingly enough, in the next line item, Mike Love, $80 million.
Well, Mike Love has kept the touring unit alive.
Right.
You know, he's out on the road constantly, to his credit.
Yeah, he works hard.
And that's what he was ranting about, was how much he performs. The one thing I will give him credit for is, you know, we have done podcasts on other musicians with mental illness, and they're off having this manic, creative exploration of themselves, but everybody else is left to pick up the pieces, and you know, there's this kind of wake that everybody else has to deal with. Daniel Johnston and Rocky Erickson and Brian Jonestown Massacre, etc.
Sid Barrett,
yeah. So Mike has been able to kind of be steady, but I would say personality type, very conventional. And so just seeing the straight and narrow ahead. However, he kicked Brian Wilson out of the Beach Boys. He has sued Brian Wilson, I think, multiple times.
Again and again.
And you know, I just think of the title of the Facebook page when I think of doing that kind of a thing. So wasn't there like a Sex Pistols song or album called We're Only in It for the Money? Maybe that was the Ruddles. I don't know.
I did read Mike Love's autobiography that came out.
I'm sorry?
I did read
I'm just sorry that you...
Oh. And one of the things that struck me in his autobiography is how bitter he is to this day about songwriting credits. Yeah. He believes that his name should have been on so many songs and that Murray cheated him out of it, Brian cheated him out of it, and it just comes up again and again in the book about, I had written this song, and he talks about it. You know, he remembers when he wrote the lyrics to this song, and he remembers when he wrote the lyrics to this song, and then the record comes out and it says, by Brian Wilson.
Yeah.
You know, so here it is, you know, 2017 or so when he wrote the book, and he still can't get over it. And I wish I brought this. I have the Pet Sounds box set, which has all the stripped out vocals on it, by the way.
Yeah.
And in the accompanying booklet, he writes the foreword. And on the first page, in a couple places, he brings up how he collaborated with Brian to create Pet Sounds. He has to get it in there.
Well, he's 5 million up right now.
That is like his Achilles heel.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it makes you think about, you know, the notion of personality running parallel to mental illness. You know, because even watching the film and reading some of the articles, I always questioned the mental health of Gene Landy.
Oh, yeah.
Temper.
I just felt like you couldn't be that tyrannical with another human being unless there's something not quite right with yourself. And I don't necessarily think I should put it that way, but unless there's some, you know, battling your own mental illness. Because, I mean, he had control of the guy 24 hours.
Very much, yeah.
For certain.
Yeah. Yeah, I would have a hard time living with myself if I were having that effect on someone else or needing to be that. I mean, controlling taken to an extreme. Mm-hmm. He called what he did, I think, 24-hour therapy, and it requires you to be, he uses this word, in total control of someone else's life at all times.
The weird thing is, despite how horrible he seemed, that Brian did emerge.
Well, he did get better. You know,
he lost the weight, put out a record, he wrote an autobiography, and even though Eugene Landy is in those things, you know, to some extent, Brian Wilson did emerge from the 70s, you know, maybe not completely intact, but functioning.
I think Brian says that he wouldn't be alive if somebody said that, if there hadn't been that intervention, which involved Dr. Landy.
But now isn't there also question about his current care? And I feel like I read somewhere, I don't remember which, might have been Rolling Stone, don't quote me on that, but I read somewhere that the quality of his care now from the people that are close to him isn't as extreme as with Landy, but has elements of Landy-esque approaches.
Well, Brian, he's in many articles, he's referred to as childlike. Mm-hmm. I think of Nigel Tufnel in Spinal Tap, the man child. And so genius, but at the same time, you know, for somebody who's called a genius, but sometimes having difficulty with basic tasks.
So is genius like code word for mental illness?
I don't know.
Might be.
I don't know.
Especially when it comes to music, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, whether God, there's so many musicians that have been called genius, but we're so racked with so many mental health issues.
Artists, right? Whether it's an author or truly artist or
someone. Well, you're creating something out of nothing, mm-hmm. and you're making it appealing to the masses.
I think there's some kind of a link. I don't know that it's causative, but often there is just these creative bursts that are also happening with somebody who is experiencing mental health issues. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to mention one more thing related to another way that I kind of got to know Brian Wilson, and I don't know if you had this experience also. So at some point, I think in the 90s or the 80s, but he would frequently appear on the Steve Dahl show.
Well, he did live in St. Charles for a number of years.
So he was, I was going to say, he also was a local celebrity in St. Charles. I've driven past his house that he lived in, which is...
St. Charles, Illinois. Making sure I understood.
But just a gorgeous house. I mean, a mansion.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, he had he had hooked up with a record producer from the suburbs, and that's how he came here.
What years was that, do you know?
Mid to late 90s. Oh, okay. And the record that came out of that is called Your Imagination.
Fair enough.
It's ironically not as good as the one that came out of the Lander years, the Brian Wilson solo album, where Love and Mercy. That
I love that song, yeah. Love and Mercy. And I'm going to say the film Love and Mercy... I didn't like it as much the first three times, but the fourth time I watched it, I felt like I got it more. And the best part, though, I thought was during the credits when it's Brian mm-hmm. Wilson himself singing the song Love and Mercy.
Yeah, I thought the film was good. I mean, I don't think it's the greatest rock biopic ever, but as a film, I thought it was really nicely done, very well directed. There's a scene that I really, really loved. They were in the studio doing overdubs. And there was this long tracking shot that went into in a semi-arc to show you basically everybody in the studio. And here's Brian over off in the corner telling the guitarist how to play with a little bit more staccato and explaining to them what it was that they were doing and what it was that he needed. And then the camera kind of tracks around and there you see Dennis sitting at the piano board. Yeah. And then guys are off in the control booth, just kind of doing their own thing, bored. And the whole thing just reminded me of, like, ironically, Ringo Starr talking about the production of Sgt. Pepper's and the White Album, where... Yeah, I don't play anymore. I just kind of sit for hours and wait.
Yeah.
And then I get to play for 5 minutes, and then I have to sit for another 4 or 5 hours and wait, you know? To see the filming of a scene like that was really interesting. Because, like, here's the space, and here's what people are actually doing. While this, like, you know, genius is micro-editing, to a certain degree, micro conducting this one small bit. But I don't remember what song it was, but I remember thinking to myself, oddly enough, that's what you hear the most in that particular song. I think it was actually Good Vibrations.
Mm. Oh, the scene with the cello is where he keeps...
Yeah. Yeah.
If the Pet Sounds box set, which came out in 96, I don't know if it's still available, but the bulk of those, it's a 3-CD set, and the bulk of it is the tracking sessions from Pet Sounds, and it's just fascinating. I mean, if you're really not into the songs, it probably isn't, but you keep hearing the same sounds over and over again, and he keeps adding sounds, and he keeps stopping them, and he says, we can't hear you, can you play a little louder? And then they play again, and he goes, there it is. And I think, I didn't really hear the difference. And I'm a musician, I have a good ear. But it's fascinating to hear how it all went down. And then again, that box set also has all the stripped off vocals, which are just beautiful.
So I wrote a really sweet article. I know we have to wrap up, but it's from this year. You may have seen it too. But Brian wrote the song Surfing in high school, was given an F.
Sweet.
On that. Yep. And was able to return this year to his high school 58 years later, and they physically changed it to an A on the transcript.
Aww.
I know, isn't that great? Angels singing. So I do think this needs to be like a 10-parter, because there's plenty more to talk about.
But. Well, I mean, even just the audacity to take an assignment that was an F and say, yeah, we're going to put this out as a pop song. And it goes number one.
Well, they made a million on that F. So yeah. Just that. Or several.
I was lucky enough in October to go see Brian at the Rosemont Theater on the Pet Sounds tour. And it was an amazing night. You know, he doesn't have the best voice anymore. He does slur a lot of his vocals and speech. Yeah. But he was engaged. You know, you hear so much about the past years where he would be on stage but not paying attention or not really playing or not really singing. But in this case, I can say he was really singing. And, you know, he did a fantastic job there. It is a little strange at the end of if it's the end of the set and he's done with his part, he just stands up and walks off while the band continues to play. He's done. And then they bring him back out, you know. And what also amazed me about that is I figured that I would hear just so much of the mid to late 60s to early 70s, you know, the more exquisite music. But he did a ton of early Beach Boys songs, including like Shut Down and I Get Around and Salt Lake City, you know. So clearly he has a love for all the music he created. You know, he's really under no requirement to play that old stuff. The people who are coming to see him are not coming for that stuff. They know they can go hear that with the Mike Love unit. But he played it anyway, which, you know, so I think he loves everything he has created.
Yeah.
No matter whether it was about cars and girls or surfboards or about, you know, feeling out of place in the world.
I have a lot of respect for him, and watching, you know, revisiting some documentaries and definitely rewatching Love and Mercy. I have to give it to the guy. He's just an amazing artist. And now he's in his upper 70s.
76.
76, yeah. He was born in 42. Yeah. So, yeah.
And so, and knowing both the psychological and physical and emotional wars that he's gone through over these six decades in the business, it's just commendable. It's amazing.
Well, he's at a point where he doesn't need to do this.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, he's got plenty of money.
70 million.
He's
75.
But he's doing it anyway. You know, he's still recording. I mean, he came out with a fantastic record just a couple of years ago. The final track on that song the album is called The Last Song. Ooh. And I hope it isn't. But, you know, so he's still recording. He's still touring. He's doing all these things he doesn't have to do.
Favorite two or three Beach Boys songs?
Mine would be Till I Die from Surf's Up. And I Just Wasn't Made for These Times is my favorite off of Pet Sounds. And those are probably my top two.
Good Vibrations. And Wouldn't It Be Nice?
I like it all. I don't have a favorite.
Okay.
God only knows.
Yeah.
Just Laura said so. Or Lori said so.
I would say God Only Knows by a long shot. And then Heroes and Villains, Good Vibrations, Don't Worry Baby.
Oh, Don't Worry Baby was good.
Don't Worry Baby was good.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to wrap up. Thank you, Mark, for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. This was fun.
Yeah. I will point out that we are all over social media, and we have a new Facebook page, Mental Illness and Pop Culture. Please like us. By the way, if you are interested in helping us in any way, you can write a positive review about our podcast in your app of choice. You can follow us on our webpage, mentalillnessinpopculture.podomatic.com. That's also where you can find all of our episodes, although they're also all on our Facebook page. We are on Twitter MINPC5, or just search for mental illness and pop culture. And our email is mentalillnessandpopculture@gmail.com.
So, I'm always so impressed by that. Yeah. That's why we make him do it.
So coming up next, if you are interested in preparing for our next podcast, we're going to be taking a look at Nebraska, starring Bruce Dern, who is dealing with some issues related to getting older, and there's lots of family dynamics in that movie.
Good flick.
All right. So we will talk to you next week.
Bye.
Later.